I'm your host, Lisa Jones, and this is the Millionaire Medium Podcast. In today's episode of Millionaire Medium with Lisa Jones, I'll interview Robert DeVink. He had the fortune of being able to retire very comfortably at the age of 52. However, between his cancer diagnosis and his addiction to drugs and alcohol, he had many twists and turns that were unexpected. He ultimately wrote the book, The Pono Principle, Doing the Right Thing in All Things, which has completely opened his heart and changed his life. And he hopes that it will do the same for you. Be sure to stay to the very end of this episode as I am going to pull three cards just for you. Welcome to Millionaire Medium Podcast with Lisa Jones. Today I am in the presence of Robert DeVink. At the age of 42, Robert was forced to face his physical mortality when his life was interrupted by stage 4 Hodgkin's disease. But it would take another 15 years before he was willing to address his other life-threatening disease, addiction. The egocentric false self that he had created over a lifetime had taken a serious toll on his marriage and family. Rising from the ashes of what proved to be his two sacred illnesses, DeVink began his transformational spiritual journey to find his true self, his soul. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you, Lisa.
It is so exciting to have you here today, and especially because you just published your first book, The
Yes.
Pono Principle,
Yes.
Doing the Right Thing in All Things. And I'm just going to...
Hey, we love that, right?
Absolutely.
Thank
absolutely.
You.
So tell us, well, first of all, we were just talking about synchronicities because I feel like you and I, our paths have been crossing time and time again. And literally yesterday, I just about knocked into you as I got out of my car at the beach. And you were hustling down there to get over to the Grand Wailea to do your workout.
That's
and I had been thinking about you to ask you to be on my show, and boom, you just appeared out of nowhere. And
there are no accidents, are there?
There are none.
No, this is amazing.
So.
And I felt the same way running into you because I haven't seen you in a while, and the timing couldn't be better. The book was just published in the last month, a month and a half, I guess, and so the timing couldn't be better.
Fantastic. Yeah. And also, you have just completed a 10-day silent retreat, which I'm actually signed up to do next month.
I know you are.
So I was grilling you about that and what I needed to know about going on that next journey. And the biggest thing you said was to bring a blanket. So
bring
I'm going to be
and,
sure to do that.
And the blanket will play into this conversation.
That's right. That's right.
It's a big part of what happened to me at the tail end of that those nine days
Absolutely.
Of Kapasana.
That's
which
right.
takes place at Pono McKenna. Pono McKenna. That's the name of the sanctuary now. I think Jorge gave it that name. He's the owner. He bought it, the property, from Joe Sugarman. And so he's been doing that, I think, 6 years now. So
amazing.
It was an amazing, you know, a lot of people put money against me that I couldn't keep my mouth shut for 9 days. So a lot of people made money on my silence because it was noble silence is what it's called. And it was just a life-changing transformational moment. It really was.
Wow.
And it's based on Vipassana. So Jorge thought it would be cute to change the name to Kapasana. He was talking with his friends one day and came up with that name. But the Vipassana courses that are taught around the world, I have a friend that lives in Lake Tahoe. She did it in India. On property that's owned by the Dalai Lama.
Wow.
And she said it was the hardest thing she ever did in her life, and it was the most transformational.
Wow. Well, for our listeners that don't know what Vipassana is, can you give just a little bit about it?
Well, it is a silent, don't use the word retreat. Jorge would insist we don't use the word retreat. It is a meditation course, and what singles it out is that it is silent, and that it is based on your soma, your body, and getting down to your sensations. It's all about just coming into contact with your sensations and letting your body speak to you clearer than it ever has before. because you're so tuned in. So in a silent environment, for example, when we get up and do our first morning meditation, we're there doing it at 5:30 in the morning when it's pitch black outside. You have your eyes closed, and the only sound is the ocean crashing there on McKenna Beach, and the smells coming out of the kitchen that Mary Ann's preparing for the morning fuel, as we called it. And then the birds started tweeting at about 6:15. You could almost time it every morning when the birds would start, when the smells from the kitchen would come about. So, how in touch you were with that. Maybe the first time for some people.
Well, yeah, how many people actually spend 10 days without speaking? Not many.
Not many. And it's a good practice. It's a good practice.
Well, I'm excited to experience it for myself next month.
I'm excited for you.
Listen in as Robert talks about being diagnosed with cancer at age 41.
Well, take me back to the time when you were diagnosed with cancer and what was going on in your life at that time. And again, we can talk about, too, were you spiritual at that time or did that kind of wake you up or...
Wake up would be a good word. I was the healthiest 41-year-old I knew in those days, in the sense that I ate well, I worked out, fed my head with a lot of Tony Robbins and Stephen Covey and so forth. So I was, but with regards to true spirituality, I was a big zero. I was a church-going Christian who never really looked to God to guide me in life. It's like I was the pilot of this plane. I got it. God was just this silent co-pilot off to the side that I would look at and say, "You just keep your mouth shut. I got this thing." And in those days, I didn't understand that my spirituality was really what I was forced. And the big discovery for me was the fact that I had to face my mortality at the age of 42. Like I say, for 41 years, I was the healthiest guy I knew. And all of a sudden, 42, they're telling me you've got stage 4 Hodgkin's disease. Your cancer is not only in your lymph nodes, but it's metastasized to your liver and your spleen. And we got to do 6 months of hardcore, chemotherapy. And I can remember sitting in the oncologist's office for my first injection. And I'm looking up at the bag hanging there, and it was nitrogen mustard. And I went, wait a minute, that's mustard gas. I remember that from my Army days. And I'm thinking, I remembered what I learned in basic training in the Army, that if you're, anywhere near mustard gas in the distance, here's what you need to do, and here's what to expect your body to do. They weren't talking about injecting 100% of it into your bloodstream to kill all of your body cells. And that was one of 8 chemo drugs I had to take over the next 6 months. And so that was that grounded me real fast. But it also turned me into a bit of a survivor, because I wanted to become an expert on my disease. I wanted to learn all about Hodgkin's. I wanted to learn what can I do beyond this toxic waste they're pumping into my body. So I had relatives and friends in Michigan sending me SEAC tea out of Canada because it was illegal in the United States. I was getting shark cartilage from Japan. I was getting acupuncture. I'd left no stone unturned to deal with this life-threatening disease. And then of course the prayers that were offered. I had people praying for me all over the place that were telling me, I believe there probably was more strength and cure in those prayers than what they were pumping into my body, I tell you that. But I think the life lesson I walked away with is I wasn't a very compassionate man up to that age. When other people had diseases and I heard, or people were dying from things, I was a very shallow person in those days, in the sense that I would say, well, that's too bad. I'm sorry for you. And I would be sorry for them. But that's about the extent of my compassion level. Once I had the disease, though, I got involved. I got immediately involved in a cancer support group. And I started doing that. Then I got heavily involved in the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Mm-hmm. I went on their board of trustees for 6 years, raised a lot of money. I was a bit of a poster boy for them for a while. But then, you know, most of the people that die from leukemia-related diseases are children. Mm-hmm. Still the number one killer of children under the age of 12. And so I kind of became a voice in the Seattle area for Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And that humbled me a great deal. And that humility really set me on a,
right,
on a spiritual journey.
After being sober for a year and a half with his cancer diagnosis, Robert returned to his addiction of drugs and alcohol.
Fast forward, because then you also had an addiction problem.
Absolutely.
So was that going on during this time as well, or?
Well, I had a 6 month reprieve from alcohol because I couldn't take it because of my chemo regimen. And so I didn't miss it. What was interesting is I didn't miss it. So even after I finished my regimen, I didn't drink again for about a year, I think it was. And that was a good thing. But then my addictions resurfaced. And so there was the alcohol and the drugs again. And of course, that doesn't do anything to elevate a human being. It only suppresses the true self, that person I write about in my book that I've been working so hard to get back to. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe that when, you know, those doctors present us to our mothers at birth, That is that person, that child of God that has been handed to in its purest form. Mm-hmm. What the parents do and what society does and what the individual himself or herself will do over the course of a lifetime will change that person. And so I'm on a journey just to get back to being that baby that was presented to my mother that day and as best I can. And so the addiction recovery didn't come for another, I was 42 when I had cancer, and I was 57 when I became sober.
Wow.
So that was another 15 years.
Coming up, Robert talks about how his addiction affected his family.
When you put yourself number one in your world, which is the common tendency of addicts in general, whether you're a drug addict, doesn't matter what the addiction is. It doesn't matter. You're putting your addiction, in the case of alcohol and drugs, you're putting your get high at as your top priority. And then, oh, by the way, I got to pick up the kids from school. Or I've got to, you know, clean the garage. Whatever those are all secondary. Or I just have to be loving to my wife today. Well, first I want to take care of Robert, you know. It's not a good place, and it's a place I lived after the cancer for another 15 years. And it was only then that I clearly understood how selfish, how self-centered I had been my entire life.
Wow.
Through the cancer, through before and after, until I was willing to just, you know, totally surrender.
Coming up, Robert talks about his bottom and when he knew he had to get sober.
It was a combination of two things. My eldest son had a bit of a reckoning with the old man on a Thanksgiving 8 years ago, where there was a lot of drinking involved, but he basically unloaded on me that I wasn't the greatest father in the world, and that's putting it politely. That affected me. That hit me deep. And then because of that, my wife, I guess, did some soul searching herself, and being the mama bear she is by nature, she tended to agree that I hadn't been the best father in the world or the best husband, and so she asked me to move out, and that was my bottom. There was no divorce. There was nothing that final, as I often describe it when I go to recovery meetings. I'll talk about I felt like I fell into this pit. But as I was falling, I found one last branch to grab onto, but I could see the bottom. The bottom is where I lose my children, I lose my wife forever, but I'm still holding on. I know what it looks like. I know what the bottom looks like. I don't have to fall to it to reach it.
Right.
And I was able to pull myself out of that pit with recovery work, and I've been doing that for the last 7.5 years.
Next, Robert is going to tell us how he's always wanted to be a writer.
I talked a lot about being a writer. I always knew I had a writer's heart. I was always the guy in the cafe that was observing other people and taking notes, and I had that in me. There was a Hemingway aspect to my life all these years. I didn't have the discipline. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the discipline. Fear was a big part of that, you know, being a perfectionist, and how that made turn me into a procrastinator. Oh my gosh, they go hand in hand, you know. I'll never be a Hemingway. It was always in the back of my mind. So no matter how good it was, and if people read things, that's great, Robert. Well, I didn't think it was good enough. Until I got to this particular book, a book I never thought I'd write. I never thought a self-help personal growth book was really in the cards, so to speak. I always wanted to be a novelist, but that was more about the ego, I think. I think that you know, let me tell you about some exciting periods in my life. I'll put it in a fictional novel, and that'll be very self-satisfying. Whereas this is all about, let me share with you some things that have happened in my life that I know a lot of other people have shared. I know stage 4 Hodgkin's touches you deeply.
Yes, I was just going to say, it's amazing, again, the interplay of my life and meeting you and your life. And again, my first husband passed away from Hodgkin's. He had both Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's. And in fact, I was going to ask you where you got treatment, because in Seattle, that's where we were as well. Oh, wow. Which our insurance company wouldn't pay for us to be in New York or Connecticut. They flew us all the way to Seattle, and we stayed in a hotel for 9 months. So it was pretty crazy.
There is good cancer treatment to be had in Seattle.
Yes.
There really is, between the Fred Hutch.
That's where we were, Fred Hutchinson.
And UW has a great program.
Yes.
There. And my oncologist was a saint, and she pulled me through. But if you're going to get cancer, I guess Seattle is...
It's a good place. You didn't have to travel there.
I didn't have to travel. No, I didn't.
That's great. So tell me about The Pono Principle, your book, and what finally, again, you've been thinking about writing for a long time. What finally got you to sit down and write?
I think it was the life purpose aspect of it that like I said, with regards to novel writing, that was purely ego. That was just, you know, like I say, I've had an exciting life. I've lived in Europe. I've known some very well-known celebrities, and they've interacted in my life at different times. And I've got a lot of good stories to share, and I do share them. But it's so tempting to just want to put that into a novel, and you know, here I look at the exciting life I've had. Hemingway did a great job of many, many novelists love to do that. This was really, I don't want to use the term labor of love. I felt that it was a charge, that I was tasked to write this from, not in a difficult way, but from a very genuine way, and I think that's how the book kind of wrote itself.
Coming up, Robert will explain, what is Pono?
Pono is the Hawaiian philosophy of just doing the right thing in all areas of your life. Hawaiians have a sense that how we treat the aina, the land, is so important. How we treat each other. The aloha spirit springs from a place of Pono. And so I learned that philosophy when I moved here 6.5 years ago. And I thought, well, you know, I learned Pono from my father. Of course, he never called it Pono. He just he was a man that believed in doing the right thing. There was right and wrong in his world, and he just believed you knew it. It was in your soul. You just knew what you know. Like Robert, well, what do I do, Dad? You'll know when the moment comes. You know, you'll know what the right thing to do is. He preached that his entire life. God bless him. So I dedicated the book to my dad because he was a living example of what living Pono looks like. He was a very conscious man. He was a good husband, a good father, and a great neighbor and friend to other people. And I just started looking at how Pono has affected my life in so many areas. How I eat, I believe I eat Pono. How I treat other people in the work, Pono in the workplace is a big piece of this. I interviewed two individuals for this book, both Hawaiians. one who's in the restaurant business, Ron Ponzo, who owns Nalu's, and then Kimo Keo, who's Kimo Keo is like the big kahuna of all the islands, mm-hmm. who I've known for years now through the Kihei Canoe Club. But I interviewed both of these gentlemen because they just live, breathe, eat, and sleep Pono. And their stories are amazing. Ron Ponzo, in addition to being an amazing restaurateur, started the Lei of Aloha. I'm sitting here wearing this lei that you so graciously gave me. Thank you. Mahalo. He started the Lei of Aloha after the Paris terrorist attack, mm-hmm. where he just saw that on television and realized those people need a hug. We need to do something. He got on the phone, and within 48 hours, he had 200 people willing to make a mile-long lei that they didn't know how they were going to do this, but they knew they were going to have to take this lei to Paris and present it to the city of Paris, to those people that, in honor of those people that were killed and the survivors from that terrorist attack. And the floodgates just opened, going through customs, the plane, the hotels. And then it was followed by what happened in Orlando, the terrorist attack there. Same response. Ron saw that on the news, said that those people need a hug. It was the right thing to do. And so he did the exact same thing. Volunteers made a mile-long lei, and they took it to Orlando. The difference being, because of the response that he got from the Paris thing, his airlines were fighting to pay for his flight. Wow. Hotels were fighting to put them up, and the volunteers that came. He has since done it in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. He did the presidential inauguration because there was so much vitriol and animus during that whole election process, and it hasn't stopped, as you well know. And I talk about Pono in politics in my book. That chapter wrote itself just because of this last election. What has it done to us as a people where we can't even communicate to each other? Families are broken up because we are so binary, mm-hmm. and polar in our views. And that's not Pono.
No.
It's not Pono. So anyway, so the examples I use in the book are just stellar examples of people that practice in all areas of their life the Pono principle. Kimo Keo, how he is involved in trying to keep Hawaiian language alive here in Hawaii, paying attention to what's going to happen now that our sugar industry has dried up. How's that land, those 36,000 acres, going to now be used? Is it going to be for a better, Aina, better land, or which direction are we going to take? So that's the basic premise of the book.
And how, tell our listeners how they can use Pono in their life. I mean, what, do you give tips, or is there?
Absolutely. It can be as simple as picking up a piece of paper on the ground that you would normally just walk by and assume somebody else is going to pick it up. That's the example that Ron Ponzo taught me when he was a manager at a restaurant. He said, as manager of a restaurant, I could stand there in the kitchen and look at a piece of trash that's on the floor and watch 30 of my employees walk by it over and over again. He said, when I was doing what they did, I didn't know how to not pick that up. That's the difference. So you can teach that. It's just a habit then. Because once you get in the habit of picking up something off the ground, even though you didn't put it there, you just start doing it that way forever. It's a great example. Now, another one is, how about, I talked to you earlier about, doing my beach walk in the morning and how I used to do that beach walk when I was so self-consumed. I had the earbuds in, listening to Steely Dan or whatever I'm listening to. And in my own little world, I would never dream of looking at another human being because I was in my own space. And I see those people on the beach walk. They're the old Robert coming the other way. And now I've learned that just putting a smile on my face with a little nod as you walk by, in the old Westerns, you always see the cowboy tipping their hat to the ladies as they walk down the street or to the gentlemen. We had an air of civility years ago that I just don't see as prevalent today. Mm-hmm. Not saying it doesn't exist. What's great is when you can kick somebody out of that place I used to be by saying good morning to them, and all of a sudden they're startled. All of a sudden they look like, whoa, Somebody just said good morning to me. Well, good morning. Yes, I'm in Hawaii. Oh, my goodness. Oh, look at oh, there's whales jumping out of there because they're so into whatever they're into. And it's not where, you know, where they could be. It's not where they could be. And that was the life lesson for me. It's just the simple things of just addressing people, smiling at people when you walk by them, saying good morning to people. Bring us some civility into our culture.
Well, common courtesy. And treat others as you would like to be treated, even if you're not being treated that way. I think it's all, and I feel like once you do, again, vibrationally, to use that word, it just, you kind of suddenly start attracting other people that are also in that.
Exactly.
In that area. Or if nothing else, you're providing a great example and you feel better. I know I feel better when I say hello to the workmen that are doing the lawn, or, you know, exactly, to the people when I walk into a restaurant or whoever it is. You're just pleasant to everybody, and
those,
comes back.
Those are the people I most enjoy saying good morning to every morning, are the mostly Filipino landscapers that work along the four hotels that I walk by every morning. Because nobody ever says good morning to them.
Right.
I never see it. I never hear it. And you can tell by their response to your good morning that they don't hear it very often.
Yes,
and it's sad because they are out there hunched over most of the day doing their little plantings and so forth and trimming so that
it looks beautiful.
It's beautiful for all the tourists that are you know, seeing it. And when I can say, there's certain ones, I've even asked their names. Little Manuel. When I see Manuel out there, I always say, good morning, Manuel. And it just, I can just see the glow on his face that somebody's acknowledging me. And once in a while, I'll even say, thank you for keeping this place so wonderful. And it's such an easy thing to say.
Yes.
It's such an easy thing to do. And I have to admit, it makes me feel good in saying it, which is fine,
mm-hmm.
which is fine, because that's a reward that's different than, you know, a financial profit from something.
Right.
This is the stuff we should be sharing.
Absolutely.
And that's what the Pono Principle is about. It's following the example of my father, the example of Ron Ponzo,
mm-hmm.
the example of Kimo Keo. These are men, in just in this example, these happen to be all men, but these are people that have greatly influenced me and who constantly, day after day, are setting that example. And they affect the people that they come in contact with.
That's right.
And you just hope that people pay it forward. They maybe you've unlocked somebody that's into their earbuds and into their own self, and they got the blinders on. And because of your good morning, they'll say, oh, wow, that felt good. I'm going to say good morning to the next person I see. Wow, what a concept.
Yeah, it's that ripple effect. You drop a pebble into a pond, and the next thing you know, the ripples continue out, and
absolutely,
it can change people's lives.
Absolutely.
That's wonderful.
No, it is. I've witnessed it in so many ways that I felt compelled to put it all together in one book, because, like I say, there's chapters on Pono and recovery. You know, because in recovery, in the 12-step programs, you talk a lot about doing the next right thing.
Mm.
It's one of our catchphrases. It's like, you know, one day at a time. Well, do the next right thing. That's the idea. So in setting your day-to-day, you say, how does it work? Well, from the moment I wake up in the morning, my first thought is, what's the first thing I should do? First thing I do is I get on my knees and I thank God for another morning.
Mm-hmm.
I thank God for granting me another day of life, the breath that I'm breathing now. And I put a smile on my face, because what's the alternative? That's the term I always use. What's the alternative? What's the alternative to smiling? What's the alternative to eating well? What's the alternative? These are good things you want to be doing in your life, mm-hmm. or you could be doing that maybe you're not doing now. And so then what do I follow that with? Well, go brush your teeth. Go jump in the shower. Do some morning meditation. Now go eat a healthy breakfast. I can eat anything I want, but I choose to eat healthy. That's a Pono decision.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a chapter on eating Pono. You know, we know I should, you know, I'm better off not eating that donut and better off eating those organic blueberries, right?
Right.
We know that. You're living under a rock if you don't know the difference between those two basics. Now, it doesn't mean you can never eat donuts again. That's fine. But for some families, That's what they bring home. That's what's in the pantry. Mm-hmm. They say, well, that's what the kids want. Well, yeah, because that's what's in the pantry. That's what you're bringing home to them. You could be buying, you know, blueberries, strawberries, especially here in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. I had a papaya this morning with some coconut kefir on it. It was wonderful. I know the fella that makes the coconut kefir. So I buy my produce at the markets where I know the people that are growing these
right.
products.
Yeah, buying local is a great Pono thing to do.
Absolutely. Right. And it's old school. Mm-hmm. That's how life was here until, you know, the Howleys invaded, and brought Spam and brought, you know, McDonald's and so forth. That's how they ate. They were much healthier people. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, today, and I talk about that in the book, that the Hawaiian culture has turned upside down. Next to Samoans, they're the most obese race on Earth, according to the Hawaii Department of Health. That's their statistics. And it's so sad because most of that was brought to them from the West. The canned foods from World War II that they saw the American GIs eating, you know, that turned into Spam. That became Spam. Then that became a staple item over here. Canned meat. Can you imagine?
Right.
Canned meat.
Living on this beautiful tropical island, which produces beautiful fruits and vegetables.
You know, but even if they in the old days when they fished and caught wild boar and so forth, or even had cattle, mm-hmm. that's fine if they don't want to go, you know, vegan or vegetarian. But at least they weren't eating meat in a can.
Right, right.
Or, you know,
processed food.
Or processed mm-hmm. food. Or frozen vegetables and so forth. Mm-hmm. That was brought. And then, of course, with the fast food craze of the 50s and 60s,
right.
Well, we did that to the entire world. That's one of the great sins of the United States
in the
commercial world.
Coming up next is the reading for Robert. And listen in as he's very excited about all the cards that I pulled.
Well, let me do something Pono for you.
Yes.
How about a reading?
Yes.
Would you like that?
I would love that.
Okay, so let's.
Especially coming from you, because this is your thing. I know.
Yeah, this is my thing. So let's just see what the cards.
Oh boy.
Have in store for you today. All right.
Pick a card. Any card.
Pick a card. Any card. All right.
There you go. Those are good ones.
Yeah, these are good ones. All right. So your first card, this is always the blockage card. And your card is action. So what I'm getting from that is that there's something you really want to be doing. And you're, again, that procrastination, maybe that perfectionism is coming in again. And again, you've been busy. You just got out of a 10-day retreat. But action is what's stopping you right now from moving forward. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because I thought I would be coming back from Kapasana fully charged, ready to hit the ground running, and it's been the opposite. Because of those days gone, I've had, you know, I got to get in touch with my publisher. I got this to do. I got the family coming on Sunday. They're all invading the house. I got all this stuff to line up. And so it has pushed me. And I want to get started on the new book, and all those things have been put on a back burner.
That's
so you're
right.
exactly spot on.
Great.
I can't tell you how personal that is.
Well, great. So your action card, which is the second card, is radiance. And so really, basically what Spirit is asking you to do is just really shine your light. Just be who you are. Be 100% present in what you need to do. I mean, I'm definitely getting the message, you know, right now, because you were away for 10 days, you know, you have to give yourself a break and just really applaud yourself for getting done anything that you can during the day. And the next steps will come when they're ready. But right now, really just be, you know, that the middle of the lighthouse there is a beautiful heart that's just shining out. And that's all you need to do. It's like the Pono. It's just like, be Pono, do the right next thing. And, you know, it's all going to be great. And then your ultimate, this is your outcome card, which is passion. And again, what you're wanting to do is moving forward in doing the next book. And what I'm being told is you're on fire right now with all of this work you're doing. I've got chills as I'm saying it because it's just so exciting, everything you're doing, and you're helping so many people. And so by just allowing it to unfold naturally, gracefully, just through your heart, your passion is just going to show and shine forth. And and allow the next steps to unfold with real grace and ease.
Now I've got chicken skin because this is so spot on. You know, we talk about being gone for the last 10 days. I've technically been gone since November. I took 2.5 weeks to go to New Zealand, followed by the Christmas holidays with the family back on the mainland. Then I no sooner get back here, and then I start the course, I almost said retreat, the meditation course, Kapasana. And then you mentioned, you know, that I need to share this light and so forth. Today is the first day I'm back on the job doing my Pono Principle workshop at the Wailea Healing Center at 4:30 today. So
fantastic.
I'm back in the saddle and I'm filled with passion to share that message. And I'm also filled with passion to start writing the new book, which is about the journey within, which is where the whole Kapasana thing would fit perfectly.
Up next, Robert talks about signs and synchronicities and how his recent trip to New Zealand is going to affect his second book.
Going through this journey, what we were talking about earlier is we both call that bigger energy than us God.
Yes.
And there's signs all around. There's synchronicities all around. I would love for you share a couple of your best synchronicities that have happened for you.
Okay. Well, I'm a firm believer, and I know we spoke earlier about this, that I really do. I believe there is a divine presence in the universe. I call that God. So if I say God, you don't have to translate that into the biblical Judeo-Christian God, although I'm there with that too. But I do believe in a universal God nonetheless, and I believe that God speaks to us. And I believe that God is there to guide us through life if we only listen, if we only open our ears to that voice. And once I came into recovery work 7.5 years ago, is really the first time I really surrendered enough of my ego, that false self that I talk about in the book, to open my ears to that co-pilot that's been sitting there all along with the map that knows exactly where we need to be going. But no, you got this guy in control here. He's going to figure it out. No. I'm handing over my pilot wings to you. In fact, I'm going to hand over my car keys too. You're going to drive the car from now on because I know you know where to go better than I do. And so just trusting in that has been tremendous. And so once I took the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth, I could start listening for that gentle voice of God. And it came to me in New Zealand. I knew there was a purpose to that particular trip. And I was praying and hoping that it would have to do with the next book. Although I'll be promoting this one, well, forever, I guess, but especially now because it just came out. But already I know I want to follow that up with a second child, which now will become a trilogy, I've decided. So, but the second child on this book came to me when I was there. I was born in 1953. That was the year that Sir Edmund Hillary summited Mount Everest. First time man, I mean, it sounds like, you know, it should have been a lot longer than that, but it's amazing that only 64 years ago did man finally reach the highest point on Earth. And he was from New Zealand. And so I happened to be in Dunedin, down on the South Island, and I went to the museum there, and they had an exhibit for Sir Edmund Hillary, and it showed his route up Everest. Now, of course, in those days, there was only two routes to the summit of Everest, and many people had tried both the North Col and the South Col routes. There were only two, and he succeeded, and he summited Everest that year in 1953. Out of curiosity, I started researching Everest. I found out that there were a total of 18 routes up Kilimanjaro. Mount Everest. And a total of 18, as of today, recognized routes that have been taken. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, because I'd been thinking about this for some time, reading a lot of Sri Swami Sanchidananda's works. He always talked about one truth, many paths. And I always thought, from a spiritual side, the correlation between the two paths originally to Everest and the fact that there's now 18. So I looked up, I Googled the world religions. There are only two major religions on Earth with memberships of over a billion members. That is Islam and Christianity. South Col, North Col routes. Those are the primary routes. Mm-hmm. And there are 16 other religions.
Oh, wow. I've got goosebumps.
of over a million members, all seeking truth, seeking God, for a total of 18. And so I realized that what Sir Edmund Hillary and his Sherpa Norgay had experienced externally on the highest point on Earth, where he left a crucifix, by the way, at the summit. He was given one thing by a Benedictine monk to, in the hopes that if you ever get to the summit, here, would you mind leaving this behind? And he did. He dug a little hole and left that as an offering to God.
Wow.
At the summit of Everest, the day he summited, May 29th, 1953. But when I put that together, 18 routes all to the summit, 18 world religions trying to get to the summit of truth and to God, I said, there's your second book. So this is about not the ascension outside, the ascension within. Mm-hmm. That's my working title, the ascension within. Because there lies the mountain we all need to summit, mm-hmm. is where truth, happiness, God, true pono, our true self, that's where we want to find. That false persona we put on, especially us addicts out there, you know what I'm talking about. That's where we have to go, and it's all inside of us. Those people who moved to Maui to be happy and then live here a couple of years and now I'm moving to Paris to find happiness. Now I'm going to get married to find happiness. No.
Right.
Just look here. It's all, or they're looking for God out there. They're looking up there in the sky saying, where are you, God? I don't see. I'm down here. I'm right here.
Right inside your heart.
That's why they always say God comes in a gentle whisper. Yeah. How close do you have to be to hear a whisper?
Right.
You know, when Elijah was, you know, waiting for God to come in the storm and in the wind, in the mighty wind, and then he heard the gentle whisper. Mm-hmm. That's where you hear God. And that's, if you open your ears, just listen for that whisper, because it's coming from in here.
Wow.
Where truth and all happiness and love and all those good things come from.
Amazing. Wow.
It's what I've discovered.
That's an amazing synchronicity. I absolutely love that. And what a wonderful preview to your next book.
Absolutely. There you go.
Well, you'll have to be on again when you get that written.
And we will do that.
Fantastic.
I look forward to it.
Well, thanks, Robert. This is amazing.
Thank you, Lisa.
Stay tuned, as today I'm going to pull three cards just for you. I'm pulling these cards, and if you're listening to this right here, right now, then this reading is for you. The first card is always your blockage card, so this card is focus. So right now, there's something going on in your life that you are not totally focused on. You feel a little scattered, you feel like things are a little bit out of control, and that you need more focus in your life. That's what this card is saying. Your second card is the action card. And the card I pulled is enthusiasm. So the main energy that's coming through about enthusiasm is really, again, it's going back to that focus. What is it that you're looking to create in your life? What is it that you really want in your life? Because there's something that's tugging on your heart right now that you are not paying attention to, or you're purposely pushing it away from you because you don't think it's possible. So if you want to change that and you want to start walking toward what it is that you are really being called to do, then you need to use your enthusiasm and allow the next step to show up for you. And when it shows up, then you need to take it. And the ultimate card, the third card that I pulled, is your outcome card. And I just glanced down to look at it because I pulled these cards without reading them ahead of time. And it's success. So I am literally chilling to the bone right now, which again, for me, is a sign of absolute truth. So if you're hearing this message right now, then this is for you. I want you to take that step that shows up towards your heart's desire and keep taking it. It's not going to be the end all be all of what you're looking for, but it's going to lead you to that next step. And then you take that step, and then you're going to be led to a third step. And the whole key to really having the focus and having your desire achieved is by taking those little incremental baby steps. And sometimes they're really scary. Sometimes they feel really impossible. But if you really want to have your heart's desire come true, then you need to take those steps, because the universe or God or creator or whoever you want to call this bigger energy than us is leading you in this direction and wants to give you what you truly want and desire. But the main thing is you have to do your part. You need to take that step forward. You need to completely trust and have faith. Use your enthusiasm to keep your desire alive. And again, your outcome is success. I hope you enjoyed this today. Again, if you liked it, be sure to leave me a 5-star review, because it really helps bring this information out to others as they will see what you liked and start sharing it with their friends and family. Have a wonderful day, and until next time, aloha. Thank you for listening to the Millionaire Medium Podcast. Let me know what you think of the podcast by leaving a review at millionairemedium.com/review or click on the link in the episode. Your review helps us all awaken the wealth within. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Before you make any financial or legal decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by Millionaire Medium. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.